Welcome to Hidden Layers, where we explore the people and the technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green. We're back with a Decoded episode today, where we cover important recent developments in AI. We're going to cover major news and research coming out of DeepMind, Apple, Waymo, Stanford, and more. As usual, to help me unpack everything, I'm joined by my colleague and one of the sharpest minds in the business, Michael Warden. All right, Michael, you ready to get going?
Let's do it.
Okay, so I'll kick us off. I want to talk about the rumored Strawberry Initiative coming out of OpenAI. There's actually some breaking news just this morning that it's going to be released within 2 weeks. So Strawberry is this new rumored method being developed by OpenAI to basically enable advanced reasoning with ChatGPT. News about this broke almost a year ago. It was rumored initially under the codename QStar. The early sort of leaks have said that it's capable of better performance, and it's mostly a focus on inference side improvements. And I'll get into what that means here in a second. So Strawberry is the codename for this internal project that OpenAI is using to not only make existing models better, but to train other downstream models. And one of the rumors is that it's called Orion. It's supposed to be text only for now. Some people are saying it's moderately better, that it's not as impressive as a lot of people were led to believe maybe 9 months ago. But these are all rumors. I think we have to wait and see. They're also saying it takes about 10 to 20 seconds when it's in this mode to generate output, so it's a little bit slower than expected. So one of the interesting things about this is the idea that instead of putting all our time and our money into the training side of model development, let's put some effort into the inference side of development. And so there's a lot to unpack here that I want to talk about. So first off, if you look at the scaling laws, and that is the predicted performance of these foundational models, and let's just stick with language models as an example here. If you look at the scaling laws, as the parameter count and data set sizes have grown, the performance has scaled pretty much as predicted across what's now 10 orders of magnitude. It's kind of amazing. But that means that the existing foundational models are incredibly expensive to train and still pretty expensive to run at inference. And there's increasing focus on squeezing better performance out of the inference side, that the sort of predictive side of the model. So one of the hallmarks, one of the defining features of these Strawberry-like approaches is that it looks like the model's talking to itself, right? It's very analogous to sort of chain of thought reasoning, which, you know, we've used on many projects. The idea is that as a part of the prompt, you would ask the model not only to complete some objective, but you would ask it to explain how it's selected and how it is choosing to solve the problem and justify it as it solves the problem. Basically, chain of thought. There's a lot of evidence that this is a strong component behind the Strawberry Initiative. This shift towards inference optimization is really interesting to me for a couple reasons. One is that if you think about it from a budget perspective, it kind of makes sense. We're putting hundreds of millions of dollars in these foundational models, and then once we're trained, we're putting almost nothing into the inference part. But what if you could take one of my favorite examples of this is, what if you could take $1 million and put that into an inference cycle to solve something like the Riemann hypothesis, right? It would absolutely be worth it, right? And so I think this balance between training and inference costs are going to be more and more of a focus as these models become ever more important to our daily lives. A couple more points. It's rumored that the Strawberry Initiative, that it's able to, this new approach can solve unseen math problems. That's new. Language models typically don't do that well on those types of use cases. And leaks also say it can solve the New York Times connection puzzle, which is pretty fascinating right there by itself. So originally, rumors were saying this was going to be later this year. as of this morning, they're now saying within 2 weeks. So we're going to know pretty quickly exactly what's going on here. But I think it makes a ton of sense to kind of focus more on the inference side as these models become more and more prevalent in our day-to-day.
That sounds great. Yeah, I'm ready to beat this thing up. There's so much hype involved with all these releases, and you know, OpenAI is continuously raising funding, so they need to just build this excitement and momentum.
So true.
And I get it. There's still plenty of residual value, but man, it's hard not to just be like a little bit skeptical until you get that firsthand experience, you get to play with it.
I totally agree. And you know, and what's interesting too is, you know, for a while there, OpenAI had such a lead, and now everybody's starting to catch up. I mean, even the, you know, you look at Llama 3.1 from Meta has been open sourced. Mm-hmm. Nipping at its heels, Claude, Sonnet. So I think there's a lot of pressure on OpenAI to continue to innovate and maintain the lead that they once had.
Yeah.
All right, I want to throw it to you. What do you got for us this week?
Believe it or not, there's actually a little bit of a tenuous thread between what you just mentioned with the inference budget topic and this next paper. I'll get there. But basically, I wanted to just go over this very new paper. I think both the topics I have are less than a week old, so this is all really fresh. But this one's a paper called "Can LLMs Generate Novel Research Ideas?" And the idea is that, like, the holy grail is that you'd have this research agent that you could either use as a companion or just, you know, hit a button and go and say, hey, go do some research and come back to me with the results. But it was looked at in sort of a narrower focus where they would take these seven different topic areas. I have them written down here. They are bias, coding, safety, multilingual, factuality, math, and uncertainty, all different subcategories of natural language processing today. And what they would do is they would choose a topic area and they would say, okay, and in fact, they actually use Claude 3.5 Sonnet because it's just such a workhorse. They said, go with this topic area, go generate 4,000 different novel research questions. Describe them in a really short way and then give them to me. And then I'll do some stuff with it. So that's the first step. And then what they would do is they would take those ideas, they would filter them just based on some deduplication, you know, just a light filter. There's not a ton to do there. And then after that, they would then use multi-step reasoning, multi-step LLM calls to try to expand on those ideas and then turn them into actual conference submissions.
Okay.
So you have a template with a conference submission where you have, you know, a topic, you have a research question, you have background, you have some, you know, like a proposed experiment plan.
Right.
All that stuff is really well templatized. And they did this blind study where, you know, they used a couple different approaches to create all these AI generated research questions. And then they used experts in the field to do the same exact thing. They ran it through a style normalization layer.
Okay.
And then they had some other NLP experts go and look at these and then rate them based on things like novelty, excitement, feasibility, all the stuff that you normally would with a journal, right?
Right.
And it turns out that on those categories of novelty and excitement, these AI generated research questions actually scored better with blind human reviews.
Okay.
Which is super, super exciting at face value. I mean, I think with all these things, you gotta, you know, look at it with a little bit of skepticism. But before I get too deep in that, I'll just go a little bit more into detail on how they did this, because I think it's important to infer basically what the next steps might be. What they did was, so once they had all these topics, they would then re-rank them so that they could, you know, filter and take the best ones and present those and everything. And they also had a human re-ranking step for this third category. And the way they would expound on these ideas is just a RAG approach. So I've got an example research question they have here.
Okay, that'll really help.
Yeah, I think it'll just make it a little bit more solidified. One of these ideas that they generated was semantic resonance uncertainty quantification. Huge mouthful.
That's a mouthful.
Right. But the idea is that, you know, like you mentioned, chain of thought reasoning a second ago, they would, the proposal here, and this is totally novel according to the reviewers, you would ask an LLM the same question multiple times, have it give you the chain of thought reasoning, and for the answers that were correct, check out how much those steps in reasoning resonate or agree with each other, and use that as a measure of uncertainty, which is a big challenge. Interesting.
Okay, let me see if I understand that. So you take multiple outputs to sort of the same prompt, same input,
yep,
with the reasoning steps being compared to each other and looking at the similarity of those.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense, right? Because obviously I think the more consistent they are, the more likely it would be accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. It seems like a cool idea. And, you know, that was one of many different ideas that they used to review and look at. But the reason I think you should couch those expectations a little bit are that, so it's the examples that I looked at, they seem to be sort of that like associative creativity where, you know, you have one idea here, idea A, idea B,
right?
You sort of mash them together,
right,
and you end up with something that's pretty novel, but not a lot of hops of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you take something like Einstein's general theory of relativity, and that all came from some insight he had when he was standing in an elevator thinking about, you know, I wonder what the difference between this acceleration is and acceleration due to gravity. That those two things, I think, are in completely different leagues. But like you mentioned the Riemann hypothesis, that is a big research question that would require a lot more than this type of analysis, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to drone on about all
this. Okay. So it's really interesting. I agree. I think there, you know, there's two types of insights. One is like combining idea A with idea B and just seeing what happens if we merge these together. And then there are just, you know, these intellectual leaps, like you mentioned with Einstein, where you have completely new perspectives that are in no way this sort of mashing up of ideas. But what I do think is interesting, and I say this all the time, we are still at such an early stage in artificial intelligence that there are, I think, really low-hanging fruit opportunities to take simple ideas and combine them. And to me, that's actually a really positive thing. It means that we're in the early stages of exploration and research, and it means that the acceleration that we're seeing is unlikely to slow down soon. I don't think we'll have exponential growth forever. Nothing can grow exponentially forever. But right now, we're on that part of that exponential curve where it is legitimate, I think, to take simple ideas and combine them and see what the results are. Because very often, you see amazing results at this stage in the learning curve.
Yep, 100%. And actually, along those lines, this is the last thing I'll say here. So since they're using RAG to provide the context for expounding on these ideas, I think it's limited, but there's so much additional low-hanging fruit. Like the, you know, there's all this research in these infinite context transformers. Mm-hmm. You know, we as humans, we can use the summation of all of our experience to generate insights. I mean, things that you did when you were a kid sometimes are relevant when you're doing research. You don't think of it, but it happens. Right now, the context is just so narrow that the output's narrow. But when we start to combine these research fields, like who the hell knows what happens? It might.
Yeah, totally agree. Completely
awesome.
Agree. It really is. All right, next item I've got. This week, Apple held their fall event as usual, and they announced the release date for iOS. I think it's 18. The reason we're talking about it here is it's going to include Apple Intelligence. The timeline's a little delayed. I'll speak to that in just a second. No new capabilities, but I think some strong first steps forward. Things like much more sophisticated photo semantic search, so you can describe something like, you know, find all the images of Julie wearing a red dress, mm-hmm, on the beach or something like that, and it can understand all of that context. Email summarization, rephrasing, I think a gen emoji, so you can create your own emojis from text and things like that. What I'm most interested in is the fact that we're finally getting past sort of stumbling over words, and we're going to have smartphones that are actually smart for the first time ever. It's been almost two decades of smartphones, and I think they're about to actually show some smarts. What I mean by this is when you are interacting with most AI assistants, and especially Siri, if you even stumble a little bit over your instructions, it just completely falls over, and you have to bail out and cancel. That's not the case with the new AI assistance agent coming in October with the new iOS. So I'm really, really excited about that. And there's one more thing that I think I should mention. Apple announced that all of the personal information will be stored in their what they're calling Apple Private Cloud. And they're also going to make that verifiable by independent institutions. So independent institutions, I don't know how they're going to do this exactly, but they claim institutions will be able to verify that all of that personal information within that private cloud infrastructure is indeed private. So it's pretty cool. I think it's a step in the right direction.
Do you know how they're going to monetize it?
I think they're going to monetize it the way Apple always does. Is they for the most part they give away the software for you to buy the hardware. So it's a part of the whole ecosystem. You want access to it? Buy a Mac, buy a phone, something like that. They're not going to charge for the software.
Yep. Okay. Cool. I'm excited. I'm ready to play around with it.
I'm ready to go as well.
Yeah. All right. You want a big one or a small one?
Do a small one. Do a small one.
All right. So I'm sure anyone that's a developer that's listening to this has heard about Cursor now. It's a fork of VS Code, and it's really supposed to be good at generating diffs for code contribution, which I think is great. I haven't personally had a chance to play around with it. There are a couple folks at the company on our lab day last Friday that got together and played with it. But I thought this tweet from Andre Karpathy really sort of sums it all up, and I just want to read it verbatim here. He said, "Programming is changing so fast. I'm trying VS Code Cursor plus Sonnet 3.5 instead of GitHub Copilot again. I think it's now a net win." You know, and he goes on to describe his workflow a little bit here. And we could probably share the tweet in the show notes. But he sort of summarizes it and says, "I still don't think I got sufficiently used to all the features. It's a bit like learning to code all over again. But I basically can't imagine going back to unassisted coding at this point, which was the only possibility just about 3 years ago."
Right.
So we've found Copilot alone to be a huge boon to our development workflow.
Absolutely.
And an endorsement from someone like Andre, even if there's a big learning curve. Well, there's a big learning curve to learn how to code in the first place. So that's not scary. But the fact that he's having some great luck with it, I think is just a good signal that all of us as developers should go back and really take a serious look at this and kick the tires on it, see how it looks.
I couldn't agree more. I'm always mystified when I talk to people who dismiss, you know, AI coding assistance. I've been developing professional software for almost three decades, and I immediately found it useful because, even if all it did was provide, a little bit more intelligent autocomplete, that is great. Just save me the time typing. But it is really, really much more than that once you understand how to leverage it and once you learn how to interact with it in a way that optimizes its output. And so I think in 5 years from now, it will be a very, very rare case that any major software is developed or maintained without some type of AI coding assistance. And if you'd have told me that, Michael, 4 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it.
No, me neither. It's moving way fast.
It's moving really, really fast. All right, so I've got a really exciting announcement that I want to cover. So I'm a bit of a big fan of sort of the computational biology field. And there's a new announcement from DeepMind that they've got a new modeling system called AlphaProteo. And AlphaProteo, this is a major advancement in the field of protein structure prediction and design. And it really builds on the work that DeepMind did with AlphaFold 1, 2, and 3. So let me set the table for this a bit to make sure that everybody understands why this is so important. So proteins are incredibly important. They are involved in pretty much every biological process within the body, everything from, you know, cell reproduction to, you know, the immune system. And the way proteins are created is through the conversion of amino acid sequences into proteins. And we don't have to go into the biology very much. All you need to know is there are 20 amino acids, and the way those sequence of amino acids gets converted into the protein is incredibly complex. Because as these proteins are being built up, they actually interact with themselves. And so they'll fold over, and the angles and the chemistry and the physics of it is extremely complex. So AlphaFold 2 was released in 2020, and it actually won the CASP 14 challenge. The CASP is this every other year challenge to predict protein folding that was started in 1994. And when I say AlphaFold 2 won it, I mean it destroyed the competition. It's very much reminiscent of sort of AlexNet back with, you know, back in 2012. And it, if I remember right, I've got it in my notes here. Yeah, it had the best prediction for 88 out of the 97 targets. So just in a huge, huge leap forward in this fundamental problem within computational biology. But AlphaFold can only predict protein folding. It doesn't really understand how proteins interact with each other. And that's where this new AlphaProteo comes in from DeepMind. So it is focused on understanding the interplay of proteins with each other. It also understands the dynamics and the functional consequences of mutations, which is kind of staggering.
Huge, okay. Yeah.
So what you can do is you can use AlphaProteo to design proteins that will bind to target molecules. And interestingly enough, we actually just participated, Kung Fu AI did, in a BioML challenge a few weeks ago hosted by the University of Texas here in Austin, where the goal was to design proteins with a predefined number of amino acids. In this case, it was exactly 80, no more, no less, that would bind to a target molecule associated with cancer, and that would elicit a certain sort of chain reaction response, and you get T cells that could come in and kill the cancer. This would have been unbelievably valuable.
I was going to say, it was just barely too late, right?
Just barely too late. This would have been unbelievable had we had this. A couple notes on the training data. Really, really important. One is, it was trained on the protein data bank. That's as expected. Unexpected is it was trained on 100 million predicted structures from AlphaFold. And so this is another example. You hear me talk about this all the time about synthetic training data coming from upstream models to train downstream models. And this is a part of that exponential positive reinforcement loop that I talk about all the time. We're in the early, early stages of this, but the work they did on AlphaFold is actually enabling AlphaProteo to do its job at this amazingly high level. It's analogous to the what we've talked about several times about Phi-3, the model from Microsoft that was trained on literally billions of synthetic tokens generated from ChatGPT. So this is really important. Last thing I'd like to say. You know, a lot of people are very, very excited about AI, and their only example, their only interactions are like maybe ChatGPT or Claude, something like that. Behind the scenes, we are seeing revolutions within many, many different fields, computational biology being one. And the reason this is so important, the reason AlphaProteo and AlphaFold are so important, is it currently takes, on average, about 10 years and over $1 billion to get a new drug into the market. That's all of the research and development, testing, FDA approval, everything. Once we can get this drug development cycle, we can get biology sort of turned into an information science, we will be able to turn the crank at orders of magnitude more fast ways. We'll see giant leaps in genomic-based therapies. So you'll get sick. You'll have your entire DNA genome sequenced. We'll have the DNA sequence of the whatever bug that you're dealing with, and we will be able to synthesize on the fly using these types of techniques, custom therapeutics designed just for you and your body to fight off that exact bacteria or whatever it may be that is causing you to be ill. And so we're in the early stages of this sort of flywheel where biology is becoming sort of an information science, and we'll be able to do drug discovery, and we'll be able to do simulated drug testing experiments all within the computer. And that's going to save an enormous amount of time and money, and that will down the line lead to saving an enormous number of lives.
I hope they figure all that out before I get old and sick. That sounds awesome.
I do too.
Awesome.
I do too. I'm really, really passionate about that stuff. There's so much going on that's fascinating.
That is wild.
All right, I'll throw it back to you.
All right. So I got a little, I'll start with a very brief anecdote. So recently I was in East Austin hanging out with Jack, one of our client partners, and then someone named Spencer used to work here. And we were just hanging out, having a drink. And then Spencer's like, hey, I got these Waymo credits. you want to go try this thing out and see what happens? So we were hanging out at this one bar. We're like, hey, let's go bar hop and it'll be fun. This Waymo pulls up, and it was, I think it was like 10, 15 minutes until it got there. Went over there, tried to open the door. The thing was locked, and we were like, what the heck's going on? We stayed there for about 5 minutes, and eventually the thing just kind of sped off without us.
No
description. It's like, well, okay, whatever. So then we called another one, and I think it was like a half hour this time to get the thing. So we get in it. This one's actually working, and it feels like you're in this fishbowl. There's, you know, cameras and stuff all over the place, and it's a research and development vehicle, so a lot of extra sensors. But it takes us in this weird route. We weren't going far. We're going, I think, you know, 2-3 miles or something. Really weird roads. Gets us within a block of the place we're going. And it was this really narrow street where it's got street parking on either side. It's supposed to be two-way, but it's barely enough room for two cars. So I think it just thinks that it's a single-lane road. Turns out it goes into this oncoming traffic, turns into this just standstill. Everyone's stuck. Turns on its hazards. And it's like, oh, I give up. I need an operator to help out. Like, oh, what's going on? So we just get out because we could walk to our next place. But there are these poor souls lined up. It's like 6 cars by the time we go to this next bar where they're just lined up behind this thing. And the only reason I bring that up is that it's still got some kinks to work out, right? Like, it's not a perfect technology. But in the last couple of days, Waymo released some really interesting safety data about their fleet in the aggregate. So they operate in Los Angeles, Austin, Phoenix, and San Francisco. And in terms of miles ridden, Phoenix and San Francisco are, you know, orders of magnitude more. It's like millions to tens of millions of miles ridden versus on the order of like thousands in Austin and LA. But, you know, a big takeaway is that they have an 85% reduction in incidents per million miles when compared to human-driven miles.
Mm.
So on the outside, looking at this aggregate statistic, it seems like these things are safer than human drivers. And I think that's an incredible thing, because I think it was maybe 2 or 3 Decoded episodes ago, we were talking about how at some point these automated technologies are going to be safe enough that it's negligence not to use it.
Right.
Because you're in the aggregate saving lives, reducing injury, and all that stuff, which I think is awesome. But I also think that, like with everything, you need to couch this with a little bit of skepticism. Not all miles are created equally. You know, I mentioned that story where we were just taking these weird back roads, low speed limits, nothing crazy going on there. You know, that in this study, there are actually a couple papers we can link in the show notes, but they didn't control for things like road type. So when you're on the highway, a lot of human drivers, you drive on the highway, it's faster. Right. But there's an increased level of risk when you're operating at those speeds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a one-for-one comparison. You know, these rider-only miles is what they call it for Waymo. It's not exactly one-to-one. But I'm just excited because the fact that it's even in the same ballpark or the same order of magnitude of injuries you get with human-driven vehicles, that's like, that's a step in progress, and we're on our way to the future.
That's really funny. I mean, what a kind of a crazy mixed story. The first one comes, won't let you in. Second one abandons you short of the destination, causes a traffic jam, but
no incidents.
But no incidents, and they're safer in aggregate. So baby steps. That's funny, man. Yeah. That's really good.
But I thought it was cool.
That is cool. I still haven't tried one. I'm gonna do that very, very soon. Okay, my last little piece of news, and this is not insignificant, is the new bill from California, SB 1047, that is around AI regulation. This has been really, really controversial within different sectors, within the research or the commercial sector, within different aspects of the tech field. The idea is that as these AI systems become more powerful, there's worry that they could become dangerous, and they want to start regulating that within California. This is important for the rest of the world, besides it being a California law, because so much of AI research and development is done in California, and most of the major AI companies are based in California. This will have a disproportionate impact. So there are many AI luminaries lined up in support of it, including Jeffrey Hinton, Asha Benjo, Stuart Russell. There's others who are pretty strongly against it. Most of, I'd say, the tech industry, including OpenAI and Facebook, et cetera. The law has undergone quite a bit of change. So there was a lot of early controversy around it, specifically around some of the thresholds being pretty low, and the idea of creating a new regulatory industry around this. Most of that has been removed. It's been watered down. The provisions as they stand right now are pretty reasonable. It's around transparency, accountability, privacy and safety and public reporting. It's kind of hard not to support those thrusts, but opponents are mostly worried about the sort of anti-competitive aspect of this, especially the idea that the big incumbents might have a competitive advantage and it would stifle innovation. It also didn't help that there were some misinformation about the bill initially saying that there were going to be criminal liability associated with that. So the one thing that I think is really interesting is that the way the bill is structured right now, it may not pass. It may actually get vetoed by the governor because there is apparently quite a bit of political backlash against this. So we'll see. It's just something to keep an eye on right now. I think we're going to see a lot of AI regulation coming in the future as this technology gets more and more important.
Yep. Yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm waiting for OpenAI to move its headquarters to Texas like everyone else.
I know. It feels like everybody's moving to Austin.
Yeah, sure does. Cool. All right. Well, I got one other quick note here. I'll just sort of group these together. They're on the same theme of the big players here. So OpenAI, they hit 1 million paid subscriptions recently, and they have about 200 million weekly users, apparently. So that's
incredible.
I think it's incredible that they got to that with, such a new product. I think it's less than 2 years old.
Yeah, right? It'll be two years in November.
But just to, as a point of comparison, I looked up these numbers for the other really big streaming or subscription-based services. Netflix has 278 million global subscribers. Spotify is at about 246, and Amazon Prime's 200 million. So, they're just in a different league altogether. Mm-hmm. And I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the long-term business prospects are of a company like OpenAI. I mean, there are a lot of smart people that are investing a lot of money there.
Yep.
I don't know how much of it's hype, how much of it's, but their monthly bill is pretty steep, especially with the shift toward more inference compute, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic, but they're going to have to figure out the business model soon.
Yeah, no kidding. And then, the other big player, Claude, Anthropic, their artifacts are now available to all users, which is awesome.
It really is.
I know you play with it. I play with it by your recommendation, and it's fun.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love that. I think the artifact capabilities will probably be incorporated in all of the foundational models here pretty soon because it's just so useful.
Yeah.
Okay, that was a lot, Michael. I think we raced through that as quickly as we could. I really appreciate your time, man. We'll do this again next month.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.